Okay, we're looking at three principles of living spiritually in a secular world. I will not ask you the first one. I will tell you the first one. And Daniel chapter 1 is commitment. It will take a commitment to God and His name and His purpose. If you're going to live in a world that is increasingly antagonistic against God and the people that follow Him. The second one we started last week is courage. It will take courage to stand in the face of those that oppose us as Christians and our worldview that the Lord Jesus Christ is the only way, truth, and life. And it's the only way to heaven. In a world that is increasingly saying, and in a church that is increasingly saying, all roads lead to heaven, for us to say there's only one way to heaven is going to bring hatred, antagonism, rebuke, whatever word you want to fill in. It's going to take courage to say that Jesus Christ is the only way, truth, and life in this society. Because so many are saying, let's all just get together. No matter, doesn't matter what you believe, we're all going to make it some way, somehow. Which is vehemently opposed by this Bible that we hold in our hands. It is complete untruth to say that all roads lead to heaven. That is a punch to the face of God, who gave His only begotten Son, who would die for every single person. It's an affront to God to say that you can get to heaven through another way and another means. It's going to take courage. So we're looking in Daniel chapter 3, and we must hasten. We are truly going to have to do the bird's eye view of this chapter. You've just heard it read. And we have looked at, last week we looked at the command to worship the king's statue, and that was a reverence. Of course, this was reverence that was given to a god, a little g, to this statue. We looked at, second of all, the complaint of the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, against the three Hebrew men. There was a refusal. I would say that it took courage to not give reverence to that statue. I would say it took courage to refuse to do what they had been commanded to do. So we've seen those things already. Let's look, jump right in. Thirdly today, in Daniel chapter 3, verses 13 through 18, there is the confidence of the Hebrew men before the king. There is an absolute reliance on God. You know, courage can be born out of many reasons. A lot of people do courageous things. I'm not sure I've really done much of a courageous thing in my life. Maybe asking my wife to marry me was the most courageous thing I've ever done. I don't know. I don't consider that really courageous. When we think of courage and we think of something that's done out of bravery, our minds immediately go to the battlefield or go to somebody that stepped in the way of a bullet, such as those in Las Vegas who tried to save people's lives as this deranged man tried to kill hundreds or attempt to kill and rain hundreds of bullets on this crowd in Las Vegas. And those who we saw pictures of who put their bodies over some of the women or the children or those who were hurt. That's, in our minds, courageous and bravery. And I believe that is. I don't want to discount any of that. But what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did that day was courageous. It took courage. They probably wouldn't have said that. But in reality, to stand up or to stand up when everybody else bowed, to courage. Let's watch, though, because maybe Even more courageous than standing instead of bowing was what they did in these next few verses. Because now they've been brought before the greatest and strongest man known at that time in the world, and that is King Nebuchadnezzar, who himself had brought these young men back when he had made his first, or the Babylonians had made their first of three wars against Israel. The first, they really did a great demolishing of Jerusalem. And there were several more, but in this first one, he brought back these young Hebrew men, as we saw in chapter 1. And now these three men who had passed the test, remember, eating vegetables and drinking water, and who had asked for that counter test, and really, in one sense, had put Melzar's head, possibly in great danger, and their own lives. Now they themselves stood before the king. It says Nebuchadnezzar, and by the way, Nebuchadnezzar was not just his normal self. He was in a rage. At least I'm hoping that wasn't his normal self. I'm sure there were times that he was in a rage. But he was in a fury, the verse says. He commanded to bring these three men, and they were brought before the king. To say that Nebuchadnezzar wasn't happy is an understatement. In fact, he's furious with rage. In verse 14, he said unto them, or he asked them a question, really. He said, is it true? He said, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, are you not serving the gods that I've told you to serve? Are you not bowing to the statue? Are you not worshiping the golden image which I have set up? Are you not doing what I want you to do? You are challenging my authority. And while it was very courageous for them to stand in the amongst when everybody else most likely bowed, now they are facing the king in his fury. And he asks them a point blank question. He is basically saying, I'm going to give you one more chance. And I want to make sure, I'm going to ask you, are you not doing what I told you to do? Are you not worshiping my gods? Probably couldn't really ask it any more point blank and more straightforward than what Nebuchadnezzar was asking. Are you choosing to follow my gods, or are you going to follow your God? That's what he was asking. Now, if you'd be ready, verse 15, I'm going to give you this second chance. I think down deep, Nebuchadnezzar really wanted these, give them all possibility, all option, all opportunity. He's going to give them a second chance where really he didn't have to. He should have pretty much cast him into the fire immediately. But I think he liked these guys at least a little bit. So he gave him the second chance. He said, if you be ready, when you hear the music, the cornet, the flute, those instruments, that you fall down and all you got to do, just get it over with. Just get it over with. You can have your life back. I don't know if anybody else would have even been around at this point. Just fall down. Nobody else will know. You just do it. You go on. You can serve your God after this. But I just want to make sure that you will do what I say and that you will follow the gods here at this point. But then you've got to go back onto your life. It's kind of the sense that I get here. But if you worship not, you will be and you will have to be cast that exact same hour into the midst of this fiery furnace that I have going over here. And again, he says, as I pointed out last week, just like Exodus 5:2 about Pharaoh, same thing that Pharaoh said in Exodus 5:2. Who is that God that shall deliver you out of the hand, out of my hands? There's no doubt in my mind that the purpose of the statue is clearly revealed. It's clearly revealed in verse number 15 and both of these verses. And while I don't know that Nebuchadnezzar clearly wanted to be rid of these men immediately, he made it vividly clear that if they didn't listen this time, they would be gone. Their hours were numbered. Do it quickly, get it over with, we can go on with life. And by the way, let me just tell you something else, Nebuchadnezzar said to them. No God will protect you. No God will be able to deliver you out of this situation. There's a story in 2 Kings chapter 18 with Hezekiah. Let me read you a verse, 35. 2 Kings chapter 18, verse 35. Going up against his enemies. He says, "Who are they among all the gods of their countries that have delivered their country out of my hand, that the Lord should deliver Jerusalem out of mine hand?" That was the enemy of Hezekiah saying that to Hezekiah, saying, "Who is your God that could do this? Who is your God that could deliver?" Pharaoh says, "Who is this God that can overtake me?" Nebuchadnezzar says, "Who is this God that could deliver you out of my hands?" What was the response by these men? Verse 16, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer thee in this matter." Now, let me just point out that in the King James, that kind of sounds like that they were taking this kind of lightly. That's not what this means. What it means is this: we've already made up our minds. We've already made up our minds. I mean, they could have already easily and somewhat quietly bowed the knee earlier. And then they could have tried to serve God in the kingdom after that. They could have kind of done a show. But they believed there was more at stake than just bowing to this God. Let me give you four things that I found that I think, as I've studied this chapter, I think that these men who are now more like in their 30s probably at this time had at stake when they said, "We're not going to bow the knee. We already know what we're going to do. We've already made up our minds." Number one, these men refused to compromise because they believed the name of God was more important than their own names. They believed the name of God was more important than their own names. Number two, they believed that if God wanted to deliver them, even from the furnace, even from the king himself, that he could do that. Look at verse 17. "If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thine hand, O king." And you know what? They were absolutely correct when they said that. No matter what happened in that fiery furnace, they would be delivered out of the hand of the king. If they died in that fiery furnace, they'd be out of the hand of the king, and they would be with God. But if they survived, they would prove, because of God's work and God's help, that God was stronger than Nebuchadnezzar and his gods. So they refused to compromise because they believed the name of God was more important than their own names. They believed God wanted to deliver him, that he would do that. And he could do that. Thirdly, they courageously served God over these gods, because they recognized that God's glory and his word was more important. His law was more important than to bow their knees to a false god. There was no such thing as a little idolatry. "Oh, well, just get it over with. Just bow here," Nebuchadnezzar says. They knew Exodus chapter 20. Let me read you a few verses, and you know them well, from the Ten Commandments. They knew it, and they lived by it. Exodus chapter 20, starting in verse number 2. "I am the Lord thy God, which have brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image, or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them, nor serve them. For I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generations of them that hate me, and showing mercy unto thousands of them that love me, and keep my commandments. Show mercy unto those that love him and keep his commandments." And then in Exodus chapter 34, let me read you a couple of verses. Exodus 34, verses 13 and 14. "But you shall destroy their altars," talking about the Canaanites and all the when they went into the land. You shall destroy their altars, break their images, cut down their groves. Thou shalt worship no other god, for the Lord, whose name is jealous, is a jealous God. These men believe this. And they courageously stood. And they recognize that God had clearly written in the law that to worship any man-made likeness was to not worship God. So even if it was a little idolatry, it was not right. Number four. And while the king gave them a second chance, no doubt a tantalizing offer, get them out of the fiery furnace, these were principled men who didn't waver in their worship of God even as their lives were at stake. They were principled men. If you're going to live spiritually in a secular world, you're going to have to be principled based on the principles of God's word. And we will not be able to be semi-committed, as we've talked about. In fact, no semi-committed person is going to be very courageous. So first, these men were committed, chapter 1. Second, because they were committed to God, they were not afraid of anybody else. And they courageously stood because they knew to do differently and otherwise would be an affront to God and his glory. We could say these men were 100% devoted to God. We can say that because if they weren't, they would have bowed and they would have gone on with their life. But instead, they stood. And they have stood since the day they stood through the annals of history as men who courageously loved God. They didn't care that Nebuchadnezzar thought of himself greater than God. His challenge to them that no God could compete to them was no barrier to their belief in the Almighty God. Their confidence in God was summarized in a few short words. Would God save them? They didn't know, but they believed he could if he willed. And I believe there's an indication that they believed they'd be delivered, verse 17. Did they believe they shouldn't worship that image? Absolutely. These men believed that death was preferable to wrongful worship. And maybe preferable should be a much stronger word. They believed that death was preferable to wrongful worship. How do we treat wrongful worship today? How do you treat wrongful worship? How do you treat the worship of possessions or money or whatever it is? It might not be a statue that's 90 by 9, 90 feet tall and 9 feet wide, but it might be just a few inches by a few inches by a few inches. In fact, we could narrow it down to this. Not even described inches thick, millimeters thick, by a few inches wide and a few inches high. Many Christians worship that. They're not willing to worship God. And they'll give up lots of things in order to have more of that. Why is it in America the average rate of charitable giving is somewhere around 2-3%? Meanwhile, debt continues to skyrocket. Why is it that in the richest country in the world, missionaries have a hard time gaining any support? Dare I say it's because we worship our credit cards as Christians, yet we don't want to admit to it. And I'm not saying that a credit card is wrong. I'm not saying that you can't have a vehicle. You know me. We've been through this before. But if you think that, I don't worship wrongfully. I am not anything like these. You know, I'm not in that place of temptation or this place that these young men or these actually young adults were at this point. We are in America. We worship our stuff. And if we worship our stuff, we are no different than bowing to the God that Nebuchadnezzar had built. Here's what I'm trying to say is, this isn't making sense. Here's what I'm trying to say. How do we feel about our idolatry? Do we fear God like these men? Do we believe God can take care of us? Their total abandonment and reverence for God demonstrated that their view of God was deeper than surface talk and drummed up hope. For a lot of us in America, it's surface talk that we believe God. It's drummed up hope. We kind of hope God will take care of us. So we need to, work more hours. We need to earn more money. We need to have bigger pensions. We need to have bigger 401ks, whatever it is. But yet we don't give. And I'm not saying this church gives. This church gives. I was looking over the financial statement of this church for the year that my mom gave to me, and I saw we had a deficit. And I put it into the folder just by all the other ones for this past year, and I said, God will provide. I don't have to worry for one second about the money in this church. God knows much more about it than I do. And worrying's not going to get me change the dollar figure anyway on that. And preaching on for you to give more is not going to change it either. But could it be a lesson for faith for us for this coming year? How do we feel about our idolatry? Do we truly fear God? These men's view of God was that he was the most important person in their lives. Is God the most important person in your life? Their love for God superseded their love for anything else, and it wasn't even close. Did they respect the king? I think so. I believe so. But they loved God more. Let's look fourthly today in the last part, and it's really the last section here. It's the confrontation between Jehovah and the king, and it's a revelation. What happens next is of utmost importance for all of us as believers living in a secular world. Don't miss this. Because this is not about who was saved that day. When I mean by saved, the physical saving of these men from the fiery furnace. That's not what this story is about. Kids, the fiery furnace story is not about three men being saved from a fiery furnace. It's about God being served and exalted and worshiped and his name being prominent above all other names. It's something we need to be reminded of living in a growing secular world. Is that the name of God will never be defeated. You can mount the biggest army in the world. You can mount the most powerful leaders in the world, and they will not come close to the Lord Jesus Christ riding on a horse with a sword. They will not come close to the power of what God is going to do in the future in the tribulation. When multiplied, millions are going to be destroyed. And when there's one last gasp and one last chance by the enemy led by Satan, it will be clear that at the name of Jesus, everyone will bow. So just because there seems to be some, and I'll call them minor, I can't for lack of a better word, there seems to be a few minor victories for the enemy and for the secular world, it will look nothing like the major victory that Jesus Christ is going to bring in the future. Are you on his team? Are you on his side? Who is on the Lord's side? I think the answer is clear for these men who would, that what side they were on. So we must recognize that no matter how hot the furnace was heated, Nebuchadnezzar would not be the winner between him and God. No matter what one thinks himself, thinks he is in his mind, no matter how hard he tries to get rid, to rid himself of godly believers, he will never win. Because Jesus Christ is already the victor over death, because he rose again. So it doesn't matter what any dictator in this world at this moment thinks. They are gaining and thinking that if they cut people's heads off, if they do whatever, the worst possible thing, the truth remains that those who are committed, those who are saved, will rise again. Those people who are kings and dictators will be judged. Leave it in the hand of God. And it's proof right here. Look at verse 19 when Nebuchadnezzar, he was still full of fury because they refused. In verse 18, they said, "Be it known unto thee, O king, we will not serve thy gods. We will not worship thy golden image which thou hast set up." And so Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury, and the form of his visage was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He was no longer just really mad. He was really, really, really mad. And he spake and commanded. He was so mad that they should heat the furnace seven times more than it was heated. I don't know if they threw more cedar pieces onto it to make it hotter. I don't know what they did. But whatever they did, he said, turn up the heat, crank it up. We're going to make sure they die. We're going to make sure that I am the winner. I believe that the seven times hotter indicates he really did desire to get rid of them immediately. He wanted to demonstrate publicly to all those around him that if they challenged his authority, they would be severely punished. His rage manifested both in internal anger and outward desire to be rid of these Hebrews. So verse 20, he commanded the most mighty men. He went around and found the most mighty men, soldiers that were in his army, to bind these men. I guess he was afraid they might get away. I don't know. But to cast them in the burning fiery furnace, you know what happened. These men were bound in their coats. By the way, what's unusual about that? They didn't normally throw them in with their clothes on. He was so mad, he said, don't even stop to take their clothes off. Just get rid of them. That's why it's emphasized there in verse 21. And they were cast into the middle of the burning fiery furnace. Therefore, because the king's commandment was urgent and the furnace was exceeding hot, the emphasis is clear by Daniel here. The flame of the fire was so hot, it went so fast that all the mighty men were killed as they threw them in. Reminds us of what's going to happen in the story in Daniel chapter 6. The furnace was probably constructed with an opening in the top through which fuel could be fed, an opening in the lower side from which ashes could be taken. Soldiers threw or lowered the three into the blazing furnace, and it was customary to remove the clothing of those being executed. But because of the haste in which the king wanted his command carried out, this practice was not followed. The flames leaping through the top of the opening of the furnace killed the men who threw the three into the fire. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down, bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. And what happens next is amazing, it's miraculous, because what the king sees is not what he thought he would see. Somehow he had a way to see. I don't know if he used a telescope, because I can't imagine him getting too close to that hot fiery furnace. I don't know how he saw, if there was a window, I don't know, but what he saw was miraculous. The king was stunned, verse 24, he rose up in haste, and he spake and said unto his counselors, did we not cast three men bound into the midst of the fire? They answered and said, that's correct, king. And he answered and said, I see four men loose in the midst of the fiery furnace. But even more, that there was four, they're not even hurt. And the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. Let me just clarify. It was not Jesus Christ. He wouldn't have known who Jesus Christ was. At least he wouldn't have known if it was Jesus Christ. Okay? When we think of Son of God, we automatically go to the New Testament. Was it a Christophany? It's possible, but he wouldn't have known it. So when he says the Son of God, he wasn't referring to what we think of as the Son of God. But it was either a representative of God or some type of, Christophany. But it was some being that was different looking than the rest. And he knew that whoever that fourth person was a representative of Jehovah. And you know what he immediately recognized? That Jehovah was stronger than him. This all, by the way, took place in probably a matter of a couple hours from beginning to end. The music and the bowing and the not bowing and the coming before the king and the throwing, it all happened so fast. So when he said, the fourth is like the Son of God, and watch in verse 26, because Nebuchadnezzar makes an amazing admission. He says, he came near to the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spake and said, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you servants of the Most High God, come forth, come hither. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came forth in the midst of the fire. I don't understand. It doesn't matter the details. I don't know how they must, if they came out the bottom hole, if they got them out of, I don't know how they did it, but they walked out. You might say, this is too good to be true. This story proves the Bible isn't true. There's no way somebody could have survived a furnace seven times hotter. Well, then you better not believe in creation. To have God form something out of nothing. How about the burning bush? I mean, we can name story after story that seems a little bit amazing, and so amazing that it's not possible. Let me tell you, anything is possible when God is in it. I don't understand it, but I believe it. And even more importantly, though, is these people, these men, believed in God. What did this admission, as we're going to see unfold here in the last few verses, I'm almost done. What did this mean that he saw this form as the Son of God and that your God is the Most High God? He's starting to say things that just a few verses earlier in verse 15, he said, who is your God will deliver you out of my hands? Now he's recognizing your God has delivered you. What does this mean? It meant the king was admitting that God was more powerful than his gods. I don't think his gods could have done this. It means that these men trusted in a God who was much more powerful than his gods. And it meant that God got the victory and received the glory that day, and that's exactly what happens. Look at verse 27. The princes, the governors, the captains, the king's counselors gathered together. They saw these men on whom bodies the fire had no power, nor was even a hair of their head singed. It's funny because when we have our fire in the middle of our yard in the summertime in our fire pit and the smoke goes over to the neighbor's house and he gets, you know, smells the smoke. No, seriously, we have our fire pit. And you know, using some old cedar boards off my deck, it gets a little hot and I'm stoking it. It doesn't take much to get a few hairs on my arm singed. Now that's just a small fire, small example, not one single hair was burnt. And don't say they were bald to start with. Because their coats didn't change. The smell of the fire wasn't even on them. God was in the fire. God was with them that day. Nebuchadnezzar spoke and said, blessed, amazing, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel. He has delivered his servants that trusted in him and have changed the king's word and yielded their bodies. that they might not serve nor worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I will make a decree that every people, nation, language which speak anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces. Their houses shall be made into dunghill. There is no other god that can deliver after this sort. And the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Now let me stop and say something. And in fact, this is rarely going to ever happen this way. There's been some miraculous people that have survived some amazing things that were Christians. But the majority of this, where a dictator or a person like this takes Christians and puts them in a fiery furnace or tries to kill them, is successful. And they don't admit that Jehovah is really, truly more powerful than their gods and all of this. Let me tell you this, that doesn't change the truth that God will still get the victory in the end. Because you might say, oh, well, he saw it happen. God has given every single person in this world an opportunity to believe on his name. Nobody's going to be able to stand up before God. I didn't know. I wasn't like Nebuchadnezzar. I wasn't like Pharaoh. I wasn't like the king that went against Hezekiah, the Assyrian king. I didn't see God work that way. Oh, yes, you did. You just didn't want to admit. Let me close with this, because the most important truth is not that the men survived. That's kind of the important truth to when you were a kid in Sunday school. The Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego survived the fiery furnace. It's not the most important truth in this story. The most important truth is not even that the king saw God work this way that day. That's not the most important truth. The most important truth was not even the blessing and all that Nebuchadnezzar saw at the end that the king gave to God and the bestowment of the Hebrews, the lifting up to a high position in his government. That wasn't the most important thing that happened. The most important truth, I believe, that comes out of this story is that worshiping God is what is right, and it leads to victory always, even if we die. Even if those men would have died in that fiery furnace, the most important thing was they stood for God. Are you? In a growing secular world, are you going to stand for God and his truth? I'm not saying you have to beat the doors of government down. That's not going to help. Paul didn't do that. We should pray. Doesn't mean that we have retaliation on our mind. Jesus didn't. It means we live like these men. And if we are faced with a situation like this, today is the day to choose of whether you're going to courageously stand. Right now. Don't wait. Today. Today, right now, is the day. You say, well, it's never going to come. I don't know if it is or isn't. I don't want it to come. I'm not looking forward to saying, I want this. But it doesn't take much for us as adults to look around to the landscape of what's unfolding in America to recognize and to realize that it's coming fast. And you better decide now. I'm not trying to scare you. I'm not trying to scare my kids. I'm not trying to scare anybody here today. But I think we better decide today. Are you going to stand?